Hey, Pioneers. Welcome to episode number 426. I am very excited for today's episode where we are going to be talking, we're going back to the subject again of heirloom and open pollinated seeds. But we're diving into actually the history of seeds in the United States going back into the 1800s and how different things then have shaped and created our current seed system. Very interesting things that you probably did not know about our current seed system, especially where we're looking at larger seed companies, and the majority of those big seed companies are purchasing their seeds from one place. And why that poses a problem. In fact, I was surprised to learn some of the things that today's guest shared. And I feel like I've got a pretty good handle or knowledge base when it comes to our current seed system and the way that things are done. But I think that it's going to be eye-opening for you. It certainly was for me, but also gives us very concrete things that we can look for and that we can do if we would like to avoid some of those situations and ways that we can make changes, of course, with our buying habits. And some of it's not even with our buying habits, it's just with our gardening habits when it comes to seed diversity and really seed freedom and a better way to say that, maybe perhaps seed choice. So buckle up. Today's episode is just a fascinating one. Lots of different interesting facts that I know you are going to love. So today's guest, before I bring him on, is Don Tipping. And Don, you may have heard of this seed company before because I have actually been a user, a purchaser of their seeds, and an advocate for years, way before obviously recording this episode with Don, and that is Siskiyou Seeds. They are out of Oregon, and they have an open pollinated, which you'll know more when you listen to today's episode on why that emphasis was there, but they have an open pollinated seed company. Don has been farming and offering hands-on practical workshops at Seven Seeds Farm since 1997. Seven Seeds is a small certified organic family farm in the Siskiyou Mountains of Southwest Oregon. They produce fruit, vegetables, seeds, flowers, and herbs, and they also raise sheep, poultry, and people. In fact, I was telling Don, I think that the way I first found their company was actually because of their medicinal herb seed selection. I had a hard time when I was starting to grow more and more of our own medicinal herbs, being able to find seed varieties for medicinal herbs beyond just kind of your standard common things like chamomile, feverfew, which are all excellent and I love. But that was how I first found Siskiyou Seeds, was actually their medicinal herb and flower section, because they had medicinal varieties that I was not able to find other places. Their farm has been designed to function as a self-contained, life-regenerating organism, with waste products being recycled and feeding other elements of the system. So basically, what as homesteading we all like to do is kind of create that closed loop, right? Like everything works together in a symbiotic relationship to improve everything. They are lauded as one of the best examples of a small, productive, biodynamic, and permaculture farm in the Northwest by many. And another thing that's near and dear to my heart is they practice stewardship, and they also mentor new farmers. So they have internships and workshops where they will teach people how to grow like they do, how to do seed saving. In fact, a lot, you'll hear Don share, a lot of the people who have went through those different programs that they offer are now some of the growers for their seed. So that's very cool to see that happening. So without further ado, we are going to dive into this episode with Don. And today's episode is sponsored by Azure Standard. Azure Standard is also from Oregon. We've got Oregon producing a lot of good things here. And Oregon is producing a lot of good things, but Azure Standard, which is where Oregon also is, has their in the springtime, which is right now, just became available. And then when they sell out, they're done for the season, but they have their Ellie's Garden. So if you did not get some of your plants started as soon as you would like, or maybe you missed that seed starting date, highly recommend checking out the Ellie's Eden's Garden selection at azurestandard.com. I have gotten actually a lot of my lavender and some of my echinacea, some of my medicinal herbs from them, as well as vegetable starts when I miss the boat on some of the herbs and getting them going for myself. So I've always had really good luck with their plants. So highly recommend that. However, as I said, they do sell out of the certain varieties. And when they're sold out for the year, they're just sold out. So if there's something that you want to make sure you're growing in the garden and you missed out the seed starting route and it's too late to direct sow that you need to have those seed starts, or if that doesn't work, I can't direct sow tomatoes or peppers here. So if I didn't get some of those started, then I have to get those from somewhere else. So highly recommend checking out Azure Standard for that, along with a lot of other needs, but they meet the gardening needs and also have, of course, a lot of great food products that we get from there as well to supplement what we're not growing and raising ourselves. If you are a first-time customer to Azure Standard, use coupon code MELISSA10 and get 10% off your first order of $50 or more. And now we are diving into this episode with Dawn. Well, Dawn, welcome to the Pioneering Today podcast.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Very excited to have you on today. Growing a garden, and especially heirloom and seed saving, are my favorite topic. So we're already off to a great start. But I thought it would be a good place to start is a little bit of history as far as it goes in the U.S., kind of with how seed production, how it has now become a business, kind of how that's evolved a little bit so people have an understanding. And then we can go to where we are now and things that are happening within seeds as a business, what's on the market, that type of thing. So historically, prior to 1924, seeds were actually distributed by the U.S. government free of charge to farmers, so that they could grow and adapt them in their different climates. However, historically in 1883 was when the American Seed Trade Association was founded. They saw the potential for growth, and they then after 1924 really came in and made where seeds were a business, convinced the U.S. government, at least from my research, to stop the free seed distribution. And then you started to have intellectual property rights come in and patents on different hybrid plants. And so prior to then, most of our seeds were open pollinated. They were kind of, you know, free source from the government. And we have a very different, I guess, climate, should we say, within seeds now. So my question is really, having that historical context, and then now we see where we have the recent GMO purple tomato seed that's available to the home gardener. How do you see things changing? And do you see us getting quicker with the introduction of the GMO backyard garden available seed to people coming back to seed saving and looking at that? So kind of how do you see the climate, so to speak, of where seeds are and all of that now? And do you see that ever shifting back more towards how seeds were done historically?
Yeah, well, it's a good framing you've set up. And just to maybe move it a little bit further into, you know, the past, is I feel like seed saving really is the defining moment of agriculture. Seed saving and domestication of animals. Like, once we had those two things, then you're doing agriculture. Before that, it was hunter-gatherer. So seed saving has always really gone hand in hand with farming, gardening, homesteading, subsistence level existence. And really, the first seed company in the world was 1835, William Attlee Burpee. So Burpee seed was 1835. So it was the first time anybody ever was like, here's seeds for sale. Before then, farmers just had the seeds that you and your family or your village had curated. And we use the term land race to describe that. And like a good way to view this is before the Green Revolution, late 1970s, in India, there were 30,000 varieties of rice. And after, only 8 were commonly planted. When that 30,000 was, you lived up some valley and everybody that lived there saved the seed of the rice that you grew. And that was just, you probably had the rice, the name of the village. And interestingly enough, I just got back from a trip to Kenya where I was invited with a colleague who teaches at Wisconsin State in Madison to help develop a farmer's seed saving network there. That they already have the ball rolling, but Kenya has the most restrictive seed laws in the world, and 95% of the seeds for sale are sold only through government controlled Bayer, Monsanto, Syngenta, DeKalb agri shops. So it was really interesting because Kenya has an incredibly old history with agriculture, thousands of years old.
Yeah.
And nowadays, it's really hard for farmers to access seeds. So that, I think, encapsulates a bit of the paradox of what we're going on, it's going on here. And you referenced earlier that the United States Postal Service actually worked with the land-grant colleges where they would trial what are the best varieties for farmers to grow in a particular region, not nationwide. And the Postal Service was kind of a new thing in the 1800s. So they used it to distribute over 1 billion packets of seeds that weren't just whatever extra seed. It was, these are the best cabbage seeds for this area. We're sending them to you for free. And in the late 1880s, 1890s, they were mailing out over 1 billion packets of seed for free to farmers. Wow. And then from the burpee seed, I think probably the ramping up of industrialization with World War I led to more consolidation of resources in the hands of corporations and away from small farmers. So there was a greater dependency on buying things rather than, like a figure that to me always stands out in my head is in 1930, 70% of the grain consumed in the U.S. was still harvested with a scythe. And just that's kind of boggling to the mind that that's not even 100 years ago. People were, you know, now we've got million-dollar combines growing on, you know, huge acreages and exporting grain to the rest of the world. So it's been an incremental shift. So I think that the ramping up of industrialization with World War I, tanks became tractors, poison gas became insecticides, and the bomb-making industry became fertilizer. So the seed trade, the same thing happened. And also you had all these people move off the land to join the war effort or just disenfranchised from their traditional heirloom Landry seeds. And then that whole trend continued through World War II and just the ramping up of industrialization. And also with the war effort, it led to a consolidation in, you know, big corporate control of tractors and things. Whereas before that, people were oxen, draft horses, draft mules, that kind of thing. So on the other side of World War II, that's where everything shifted. And the first hybrids came about then because there was such a push on yield, particularly for corn. So in the 1950s is when we saw the first hybrid corn varieties. And it was all about how many bushels per acre. And so part of that was going hand in hand with fertilizer. It's not purely genetics. And also water distribution. I know here in our area, there was no pressurized water for agriculture until the late 1930s. So it really limited how much you could grow. It's really genetics, fertility, sunlight, and water. That's what determines how things grow. So, and then marketing really came in with that too, to show like these hybrid corn varieties are better. And then I think that shifted the mindset of people away from heirlooms. And the other unfortunate thing, before that time, the entire food supply was based on heirloom open pollinated genetics all over the entire planet. So then all of a sudden you get universities, chemical companies, and big ag involved in proving that their hybrids are better. Well, they're only better if you use the fertilizer and, you know, on good ground under optimum situations. And obviously their end goal isn't more food, it's more money for them.
Yeah.
So we've seen an incremental erosion in the quality of the heirloom open pollinated seed supply. So for instance, like a Detroit dark red beet from the year 1900, if we could go back and get that seed, it would be far superior to what's available now because all the resources for plant breeding and improvement have all gone into the hybrids, not because it's better, but because they have proprietary control. And this is where then we get into layers of intellectual property. Utility patents, GMO, trademarks, things of this nature. And we basically stopped doing varietal improvement work as a country on the open pollinated varieties with the advent of hybrids. So that's why usually the definition for an heirloom, it's not a line in the sand. It's like, well, it's pre-hybrid. It's a variety that's been in cultivation since before 1959, which is when the first commercial hybrids were out there. So that's kind of represents the arc, and everybody kind of knows the more modern history of the last three decades going down that path.
Yeah. Which actually, I'm glad that you brought up the definition, because we hear terms heirloom, heritage, open pollinated. So all heirlooms are open pollinated, but not all open pollinated necessarily means heirlooms. And also, I think it's really interesting where we're talking about still with breeding, because I think a lot of people think, well, if you have an heirloom seed, then that means that it is as it is, right? Not necessarily with the breeding aspect, you know, with our heirlooms, you know, to continue to get a better plant, which is to me the beauty of seed saving is I can seed save and actually create something that is more acclimated to my specific area, you know, my needs, my growing season, all of those things. And over time, get this plant that is truly suited for where I am and what I'm doing that you never get with the hybrids. But and back to that, because I just get all kinds of excited about it, is explaining kind of a little bit about the difference though between open pollinated versus heirloom. And then start to talk about the breeding of the heirlooms in order to create, I don't know if better strains is quite the right word, but I think you probably get what I'm getting at there.
Yeah. Well, it's adaptability. And you know, we get questions as a seed company a lot of like, how will your seeds grow here? And it partly is because people, the seed industry has really obfuscated the farmer who grew the seed, their role from the equation. So you have, for instance, I'll pick on Johnny's, is in Maine. The vast majority of that seed is not grown in Maine. Maine is not a good area to grow seed. It's too humid, short season. Most of the brassica seed in the world, cabbages, mustards, radishes, and so on, is grown in Oregon and Washington. It's the best brassica growing region in the world. So even if you're buying from a seed company in New Mexico or Colorado or Maine or New York, that broccoli seed is coming from, you know, Northern California, Western Oregon, or Western Washington, 100% chance. So there's no way that they can be breeding for it. Another good example of this is the situation we're in now. Most of the big seed companies are Dutch, like Enzazaden or Bejo, B-E-J-O, are Dutch. They do their breeding work in, or the seed production in Western Washington, in Skagit County, because it's the perfect area to grow spinach seed. Like for spinach, for example. But where most of the spinach is grown is in the Central Valley of California, in the San Joaquin and Salinas area. So they're breeding for that environment, the growing conditions, the diseases, the agronomic qualities, doing the seed production in Washington, but the company's from Holland. And that, I think, really typifies how things are working. Or for instance, carrot seed. Maybe they grow the carrots in California, and then they ship them down to Chile to do the second year of production because it's a biennial. Yeah. So that's a very confused carrot at this point. So in one in one solar year, it's doing its whole life cycle, where normally it's over two solar cycles. And that's the industry mindset, is not thinking about adaptation. So you can either support the plant from the inside through good quality soil, organic matter, biodiversity in your garden or farm, or from the outside with crop supports, which would be like a greenhouse or row covers or agrochemicals. And the industry mindset is the latter, whereas how agriculture got to where we are now was entirely through the former. And one of my mentors and colleagues, Gary Nabham, who's written 42 books, basically about different things about ethnobotany. He's down in Tucson, Arizona. He wrote a book called Where Our Food Comes From that he retraced the steps of Nikolai Vavlov that we really should be saying in the same sentence as Darwin or a Jane Goodall or, you know, somebody of this level, or a Newton. Vavlov really cracked the code on where did all of our food and useful plant biodiversity come from. And then he traveled to those areas of the planet in the early 1900s. And by 1910, had the largest seed bank in the world because he was trying to avert famine. And ironically, he died in a gulag prison for being an intellectual elite under Stalin's, you know, oppressive rules. Anyhow, Gary Nabhan wrote this book where he retraced Vavlov's steps, and he makes a statement in there that 99% of the work of improving our food plants was done 300 years ago. So whatever we've done in the last 300 years amounts to less than 1%. And that can be, you know, so if you start with, like, let's say I was just in Italy too. Italy is the same latitude as where I live here in Southern Oregon. So the same length of day, similar Mediterranean climate. So an heirloom bean or beet variety or chicory from there is going to do really well here. It's a similar climate, even though it's not local. So understanding your climate analogs is actually a more important determining factor than local. Because, like, for instance, you know, if you live in Western Washington, just go on the other side of the Cascades, it's a whole other planet.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You would probably do better with seed that we grew here because we're west side of the Cascades.
Yes.
Than you would from something out in, you know, Yakima or something.
Yeah.
So it's complicated. And we have, you know, like, nature is complex, but human systems are complicated and fragile and brittle. So I think this is, we have a retraining that, you know, hybridization is happening all the time in nature. We're all hybrids of our parents. Hybrid isn't bad. But once you go to, like, a proprietary F1 hybrid with secret inbred lines so that the company can charge you 40 cents a seed for a hybrid melon, which is, that's how much they cost, is about economic control. It's not about being better. Maybe it's better. The industry creates prima donnas that do really well in very specific circumstances, but they don't do well across the board, where for us, what we're doing is we're trying to create, you know, what we call workhorse varieties. They're not prima donnas, and they do well in any situation. And part of that is, I call it Darwinian farming. I don't baby things. You know, we give it enough compost, enough so the plant will live. But if we were fertilizing like crazy and getting great yields and perfect conditions, that would mean that the seed would require that. Yeah. Whereas if we give it like just enough, kind of like as you're raising kids, you don't want to baby them too much. They need to understand the world can be a tough place. And so again, with our plants, and you think of where all this stuff came from, just being in Kenya and looking at, like, there's no irrigation. All the farmers are just working with the rainfall. So when there's a bad drought year, there's like famine that goes through. But whatever makes it through to make seed in those difficult times has what really are epigenetic adaptation. And that's where you want to, anytime you're saving seed, want to be thinking of a population. Save seed from 50 plants, 100 plants, not just the best looking one. And, you know, this can get complicated really fast, but it's really pretty simple. It's survival of the fittest. That's how nature got where it is now. And the better you can do to understand that, you will have more success in your endeavors.
Yeah. I actually kind of wanted to backtrack a little bit, because mm-hmm. I think that there's a common misconception, which is exactly what you talked about earlier, that people assume that the seed company that they're buying from is raising and growing and doing the seed saving of all the seeds that that company is selling. Yeah. And as you've stated, that is not the case for a large majority of seed companies. I know this is where you guys are different, but can you kind of talk about that? So is there basically like some large farms, or it's just something that they contract out? Like, kind of how in the general, I guess, yeah, corporate big business, like how is that actually done?
Yeah.
Is it just white labeling of a lot of seeds, or they just contract out to different farmers in different places of the world?
I think it depends where in the seed system you're interacting with it. For instance, here's an example that is a good anecdotal one. So Delicata winter squash is something that people are familiar with. Yeah. There was one big grower in Colorado, which is an excellent place to grow winter squash because the hot, dry summers. And somehow that is Cucurbita pipo is the genus and species, which is the same as pumpkin, summer squash, and those silly ornamental gourds. Some ornamental gourd pollen got into that huge production grove. Maybe they were growing 2,000 pounds of seed. That was the Delicata squash seed in the Johnny's catalog, in the Fedco catalog, in the Botanical Interest catalog. It was everybody. It was the same seed.
The same seed.
But one in 1,000 fruits had that bitter gene in it, and people would have an almost anaphylactic shock level of, physiological response to the bitterness and have to go to the hospital. Wow. So they had to get rid of that whole seed lot because it was a big liability problem. A buddy of mine up a little bit north had some old Delicata seed in a freezer because seed will last a long time in a freezer. And they now call this one Zeppelin Delicata because it's kind of like a Delicata looks like a...
Yeah.
And so that's one of the one varieties that we sell because it was known to have been, pure before that happened. But that just shows one angle on it. Another good one, I haven't been there, but there's another big order fulfillment facility in Colorado. And it's a giant warehouse with doors on multiple sides. It's the same seed, Lake Valley and Botanical Interests, those two seed companies, it's the same exact seed company. They're different brands that appeal to different market demographics. Burpee, Gurney, it's all the same seed coming out of the same order fulfillment facility. Mm-hmm. And we have federal germination standards that say, like, for instance, winter squash needs to be, I think, 85%. Carrots are like 65%. So let's say they have a carrot seed lot that's germinating at 90%. They'll add old dead carrot seed to bring it down to 65 and sell that. Because most gardeners don't know. Yeah, it's filler. It's fluff. Gardeners don't know. They'll blame themselves. They don't know. Farmers, on the other hand, like what Johnny sells is going to be good seed. What high mowing sells is going to be good seed because the farmers will know, like, no, I had everything just right, and they have warranties on it. But with that said, the seed trade is global. At one point, this is probably 15 years ago, the buyer, we were growing seed for a big national seed company. I won't mention the name, but we all know who they are. We were at a barbecue here with a bunch of our seed growers, and he mentioned that 70% of the seed that this company sold came from China.
Wow.
And that's very common. Another big seed company that will go unnamed, but they really popularized the term heirloom, which, I think confused a lot of people because we have a lot of customers that call us up or email and are all your seeds heirloom? And I'm like, no, because some of them are like this Zeppelin Delicata is not an heirloom. It's a newer variety, or like Honeyboat Delicata, or there's many wonderful new varieties that are not heirlooms, but they're open pollinated. And I think people conflate those terms, and the marketing from these seed companies has really confused people. Whereas thankfully in the last two decades in particular, there's been this resurgence of farm-based seed companies, like what we do. We've been doing it for 15 years, where we literally tell you who grew every variety. There's a code and you can find it out. We grow about half the varieties and we work with a network of growers because there's no way with cross-pollination that we could grow everything here on our farm.
Right.
So that's really, and a friend coined the term of like, you want to put a face on the seed, or Susan Weed, the herbalist, had a saying of she's on the non-barcode diet. If it has a barcode, don't buy it. Because in a grocery store, you can get an organic pear from Argentina, but it's got a barcode. Is that the kind of food supply do we want? Or you just enjoy pears when they're in season from your local farmer, your own garden, farmer's market, something like that. So again, we get really complicated. Like John Muir said, nature, when you pull on any part of nature, we realize it's connected to every other piece. And our human systems, we're still nature. So it gets complicated quickly.
Well, but I think it's good to know because, we see this in, with the cattle industry and a lot of that where you're down to a few processing plants and these big things. Yeah. And so if something goes wrong at that, then the whole food supply system, at least in America and our modern, thing exactly. is affected. Whereas if it's a small area and like your farm has an instance with this, it's not affecting the seed crop. Mm-hmm. of the whole U.S. because that's where they're buying from. So the diversity is super important, not only in the genetic aspects of it as well, but also in our distribution. One of the things that, because you're right, a lot of people do confuse heirloom with open pollinated as well. And so kind of what I'd like to talk about is when you're doing the open pollinated and the breeding, because people get confused with, what an F1 hybrid means versus doing, breeding and stabilizing that out, which you can obviously do with the open pollinated. So a little bit about when you're looking at doing open pollinated and you know, like you said, you kind of to truly call it heirloom, most people are saying you're going back to, you know, prior to the 1950s when all of that happened, a specific year. But how long does it take to stabilize? You know, are there specific, I'm assuming there's specific traits, characteristics that you're looking for. You happen to garden like me. I do the least amount of babying possible. And what makes it is like hot dog. That's what we're keeping and going with from there on out. But can you kind of talk about that and what that process looks like as new breeds are being developed, but from an open pollinated source?
Yeah, you bet. Another colleague of mine coined this term, the heirlooms of tomorrow. And this describes, you know, the varietal improvement work that a lot of us are doing. You can either be, and you can see some old open pollinated varieties might be like Cobham improved marrow parsnip, you know, to differentiate it as it was improved from the previous version. You know, at one point, do you give it a new name or just say this is improved or reselected? Because when we do seed production, you want to, you know, with the open pollinated crops, you need to have 100 plants minimum that you're saving seed from. Thankfully, the cucurbits, you can get down to 5, because you can imagine 100 pumpkin plants takes up a lot of room. And that just has to, I could get into the reproductive biology of them, but you don't tend to bottleneck it the same way as if you were to save seed from just 5 corn plants. That would be a big genetic bottlenecking akin to, in humans, like mating with a close relative, just we all know you don't do that. So you want to start with a good sized population. Let's use radishes as an example, because it's an easy one. You could grow 1,000 radishes in a 40-foot bed in your garden. That's way more radishes than most of us want to eat. But let's say you have a variety that came to you from somebody you respect and care about, you like it for various reasons, and you want to save seed. So grow it, you know, 1,500 if you eat, you know, let's say you're doing 500. We'll start simple. Well, I'm going to go back to 1,000 just to use, you know, percentages more easily. Eat 900 of them, give them away, feed them to your animals. But what we'll do is we'll dig up all 1,000 on one day, just pull them up, look at them all, then go through and evaluate what the best 10% are, 100. And some of that might be eating, some of it might be the way the tops are, like flea beetles are a pest for us here. So I want to select for ones that don't have much flea beetle damage, or I want to select for ones that don't have much wireworm, which is the larval stage of the click beetle. It's like a little orange pointy maggot kind of creature.
Yeah.
There are a lot of traits that you can look at, obviously color, flavor. And we get down to our 100 favorites, and you just pinch off the tops, but leave about a centimeter of the growth tip, and the plant can regrow. Replant those 100 best ones, and you just did a huge improvement work, because with radishes, they haven't crossed at that phase. So whereas with a squash or something, by the time you're looking at the fruit, they've already cross-pollinated.
Right.
So the root vegetables is a really nice, easy way to start with varietal improvement, because you can get a lot of advancement quickly. So plant those 100 back in the ground, they'll flower and grow and make seed, and you just, you know, adapted it much better for your climate. Some things are more difficult, like the squash I mentioned or corn, but it's always a numbers game. And another way to think about it too is like, go back to before modern agricultural universities, some farmer anywhere in the world going into their corn or maize. Even if they weren't paying attention to saving seed from the best ones, even if you were just harvest all the grain, wheat, corn, rice, whatever, it doesn't matter what it is. And then it comes back time to planting season. And this is how most land-raised farmer varieties were developed. They just scooped in there and took out enough seed to plant again. But imagine the plants that did better for whatever reason will produce more seed. So even just doing, that's called mass selecting. You will be always the ones that do better. It's just like in humans, the ones of those of us that have more kids, our kids are going to be more represented in the you know, the gene pool in the future. If you don't have kids, then that's just not going to happen, you know, unless you have a sibling, and then at least some of your genes are moving on. So same in plants. So it's a numbers game. There are, because we now understand genetics, and ironically, when Darwin, I just reread Origin of the Species, we didn't have that word genetics. He didn't even know what he was looking at. But he figured it out just through the patterns of observation But now that we know this stuff, you can do like what I was saying, select the best 10%. There are other steps you can go to too. So let's say you took, I'm just going to share, here's how traditional plant breeding works. Those 100 best radishes, we plant those ones back. Then we save seed from each of those 100 plants in a separate bag. So then we have 100 mothers. We don't know who the father is because they're all cross-pollinating. But we know who the mom is because the mom, the seed from that one radish plant, all have the same mom. So one mom can have many dads. They could have themselves as a dad, or other ones, their neighbors, or one from really far away, a drunk bee got over there. So then if we plant the seed, 100 little patches of radish the next time, this is called half-sibling progeny rows. So let's say we plant 100 rows. Each one represents one mother plant. Then we could go in and look at, okay, well, which are the good ones? Do that whole same thing all over again. Dig them all up, look at them. But here you begin to see the deleterious genetics expressing themselves from the male side. And again, in plants, they're not actually male and female. It's pollen producing, pollen receptive, because plants can do the whole myriad. They can have male and female plants. They can have male and female flowers on the same plant, like a squash, or they can have male and female flower parts in the same flower. So
like your bees.
Sometimes using human or mammalian terminology isn't helpful, but that's what older botanists do. So you have to go with it. But doing that, then you're able to skip like 5 years of mass selection by doing this half sibling progeny process. And any GMO, any hybrid, this is how they're getting to their parent lines, is doing this traditional plant breeding. It might take place in a molecular biology lab. Because then what you do, so here's, go back to that, so people can understand. It's not rocket science, really. If you were ever to go into a molecular biology lab and have somebody explain to you, like, I could do this. But they make it sound so fancy. But basically, let's say you have those 100 ideal radishes. Start a seed in a little pot in your microbiology lab. Then when it's a plant, just a like little seedling with two cotyledons, you could take a little leaf sample, run a genetic assay on it, then they know the correlation of this gene codes for this. Let's not even plant that one because it doesn't have the genetic sequence we want. So it's a way to sidestep a lot of work. In that instance, molecular biology is an excellent tool, and we could be using it to grow more drought tolerant crops, all this. But the sad thing is most of the gene labs are controlled by the big GMO ag folks, and they want to profit on the other end. Whereas our land grant colleges were designed to support the local farmers and gardeners. And they could be doing this work to benefit us all. Once you go to messing with the genes, that's where I believe you've crossed the line. I tend to believe in the sanctity of nature. So
I agree. Don't
mess with it. Then I believe you're crossing a line. And we're seeing the, you know, negative outcomes of that because it's a whole mindset. But genetics alone, it can be a good tool. But once you add chemicals, economics, and proprietary control, that's where it goes off the rails.
Yeah. So when you are looking to stabilize, right, the specific traits that you're breeding, about how many generations does that end up taking? Or is it variable?
Yeah. It all depends. Corn is a fun one to start with because, like, let's say you have a flower corn you really like. Let's say it's just a red flower corn. And you plant just the red. But let's say over in some other part of your garden, you're like, oh, I actually want some sweet corn. You plant it later. But it's a white sweet corn. When you go to harvest that red flower corn, if you see white kernels, you knew it cross-pollinated. You can literally take a knife and just pop those ones out and you're good. That's really easy. And I've had ears that are like half red on one side, half white on another. And corn, you see it in the first generation. So I use that every year when we do seed saving classes here as a teaching tool. Something like a biennial, like an onion or a cauliflower or a beet, it takes much longer because you have, it takes 2 years to get the seed. And I remember when I was new in my seed saving, seed growing, I was like, I'll just grow onions and work on it every year. And then an elder mentor of mine pointed out, but he's like, well, no, but then you're just leapfrogging. Like they're not actually related. They're not flowering at the same time. You have two populations and there's no way to shortcut it unless you go south of the equator. And that's what the big dogs do, is they can accelerate it, but then you're confusing the plant. And I remember High Mowing had a seed lot from Bayho, and I bet Johnny's was selling the same seed of a carrot that they did this with. And a buddy of mine grew like a half acre of carrots for organic wholesale and markets. 40% of them bolted in the first year. That's unacceptable. Carrots are a storage crop. I mean,
yeah.
And it was because they were doing this, trying to take shortcuts to get a product to market quicker. And seed work is slow. It takes time. So let's say you have, like, I'm working on a few varieties of zinnias, and zinnias are a good spot for a good crop for any of the flowers, really, for plant breeding, because you can see it. It's not about like drought tolerance. You can't see drought tolerance very easily unless there's a drought. But with zinnias, I find I can do it in about 3 or 4 years. I can come up with an idea, let's say from like a mix, like Benary's Giant or State Fair mix. I'm like, oh, I really like that one. And in about 3-4 years, and I have to grow it in isolation, like in a greenhouse somewhere. Mm-hmm. So it's not cross-pollinating with other zinnias. I can have a staple variety. So that's an annual crop. The self-pollinated crop, super easy. Like lettuce doesn't cross unless you physically touch the flower. Beans won't cross unless you have to like open up the flower. And
so, okay, on the beans, while I have you here, just because as I shared with you earlier before we started recording, but my audience is familiar, like my family's been seed saving 2 different varieties of pole beans. One is a dried shell bean. The other is a green bean. And then we use it just as a white dried bean, the excess and save for seed. However, for the most part, that is true. But I have had where you've had rows of each variety that were planted too close together will start to get genetic drift and cross. It's a small percentage, but I found even just doing 20 feet between the rows, that's enough that then they won't cross. So even though, yes, the pistil, the stamen is inside that bean flower and they should be pollinating each other before they open, I have had where they have had a little bit of crossing that I can visually see, you know, see that in, and so have learned to isolate or just have further apart. And then obviously if I did see any crossing, we would just eat that one. It wouldn't be one I would seed save from. So have you noticed that with?
Well, it's kind of like in permaculture, we have this kind of cop-out answer of it depends. You know, there's never absolutes. You know, like mammals don't lay eggs. Well, what about platypus? You know, there's always an exception to, you know, those weird kind of missing links.
Yeah.
So with beans, just being in Kenya, we went to a university and met with their agronomy department, and they work. Beans are a really important staple crop throughout Eastern Africa, and they have a lot of crossing in beans. And part of it is, I think, because of year-round equatorial growing. And maybe when the beans are flowering, there's not much other pollen sources. So pollinators are more
just visiting.
They're just hungry for nectar and pollen. So same here, like honeybees don't fly unless it's over 50 degrees and wind under 15 miles an hour. Bumblebees are out there even on a misty, rainy day looking for stuff, and they're hungry. So they will chew through flowers to get at the nectar or pollen. Then they're creating cross-pollination. You know, again, unless you spend a lot of time just sitting there watching, you're not seeing this happen. Yeah. And likewise, within beans, we're talking about mostly Phasoleus vulgaris, but the Phasoleus coccineus, the runner beans
that's what mine are.
East Africa,
the
called broad beans. But to us, broad beans is fava beans. So again, you got to learn your Latin names if you want to do seed saving. There's just no way around it, because the runner beans cross-pollinate wildly.
Oh.
Readily. Yeah. So they're an exception to the rule. Whereas lima beans, tepary beans, lima beans are Phasoleus lunatus, you know, and the common bean is Phasoleus vulgaris. They generally don't cross. But in the incidents where they're the only flowers in town, the pollinators are going to go there. So if you're doing seed saving, it's always behooves you to have agrobiodiversity, to have, you know, like we'd hear about the three sisters, and different native indigenous farming traditions would talk about the fourth sister being either sunflowers or marigolds. And you could, or I've also heard cosmos. So you can think that it's introducing some element that's supporting the whole system besides beauty of nectar for beneficial insects and pollinators.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that side, that little side thing.
Yeah.
I did want to come back to Siskiyou Seeds, to your company. And some of the things that you guys are doing. And so part of your guys' mission statement says that you collaborate with small organic farmers, which I have to say, when I first found your seed company quite a few years ago now at this point, that really got me excited, because I knew then that it wasn't white labeled and that I could see the farms that these seeds were being grown at were very similar to my own growing environment. Mm-hmm. So can you kind of talk about what that entails, how you guys are doing, you know, different than a lot of the other companies, which we've already covered that's not what they're doing. You know, they're buying from this one source, and how that is different, within this partnership than just reselling seeds like a lot of other companies are doing.
Yeah. One of my early mentors, Larry Middleton, he worked for Enza Zaden, which is one of the big Dutch seed companies, for many years. And he had a saying, he's like, most seed companies are just paper companies. They print catalogs and packets and just need a little bit of floor sweepings to put in it, because most gardeners don't know the difference. And, you know, and that I think by and large is true. Again, there's a lot of exceptions. So when I got into seed saving as a company, I had already been growing commercial seed for other companies for about 15 years. So I already knew how to produce seed. And then I was selling them basically to companies that were brokering. But different than being a seed broker, a lot of these smaller seed companies that are working with a network of growers, we are, like for us, we produce an Excel sheet of saying, hey, these are the seed varieties that we need produced. Here's how much seed we need, pounds or ounces or whatever, and here's the price per pound. And we mail this out to a network of about 24 growers, most of whom we know personally, they're friends, that are growing for other seed companies, many of whom have been students or former interns. So they've come through our thing, and, you know, we share all our secrets, and they go start their own thing, and they're out there making money doing what we do, because seed can travel. So it's not like a farmer that's selling the farmer's market. You might not want to share all your secrets, because an intern might open up a stand right at the same market, and there you are competing. But seed, we have the internet, and it's light. We can mail it. So we are specifically contracting with these growers. So let's say if we need 10 pounds of some heirloom pole bean, that grower is saying, I'll grow this for $12 a pound, $15 a pound or something. They're agreeing to not sell it to another company. Or if they do, if they're like, well, I'm going to plant more of it, but we're first in line to get that 10 pounds. And if they have extra, it's I don't own the genetics. Even if it's a variety of bread, I'm like, if nature made this, you know, if you want to say I bred it, cool, but I don't require royalty or anything. I feel like that's a little egoic personally. So we work with this network. Unfortunately, because when I started growing seed, a lot of my friends and mentors were older, and I'm watching a lot of them either retire or actually pass away. So thankfully, we're training these new seed growers all the time. And because we've been doing it for 15 years, we do get cold calls from younger organic farmers saying, hey, I'd be interested in growing seed for you, which is great. And really, you know, so we have our mission statement, but then above that, our North Star is that we become obsolete, because seed saving becomes so widespread that we don't need seed companies. People would be like, why would I buy seed when I could grow better stuff myself, or trade in my community, or work in some kind of cooperative network? So, you know, a lot of the people that grow seed for us are growing for four or five other companies. And sometimes we'll work with a seed grower for a number of years and it works well for them. And then they get to the point where they don't want to grow 10 pounds of bean seed. They want to grow 100 or 500. And we just don't sell that much. You know, we're at a certain small scale, so we can't compete. So sometimes we lose growers because they're scaling up their operation to make mortgage payments or whatever they're aiming to do, which I understand. So it's helpful that we are been doing the Seed Academy here for 14 years now, spring and fall. It's like an on-farm weekend intensive. So, you know, and a very small percentage of the people that come to that actually become organic seed growers. Most people are just wanting to add a new tool to their tool belt. But it's been beneficial of not only for our company, but other companies are benefiting from having the knowledge and skill set of seed saving more widely distributed.
Yeah. So I'm glad you brought up your Seed Academy. So I know part of the curriculum includes seed libraries. Is the seed library similar to like a seed vault, or what exactly is that?
Yeah. You know, and interestingly enough, my friend Ken Green started the first seed library in the world, as far as we know. And that became Hudson Valley Seed Library. And now they shortened it to Hudson Valley Seed Company. And they're now just a seed company. But it, when he was a librarian and was like, oh, what if we checked out seeds? And that's an interesting idea. I think it's a, any way that people can enter the seed world is great. I think it shouldn't be exclusive. And you can see kids that see dry beans will just instinctively grab them and open them. It's not, you know, it, you can access it from all levels. So sometimes I was more enthusiastic about seed libraries and seed swaps before I had a seed company. And now that I have about 10 employees and we earn a living having a seed company, and I put a lot of energy into doing a good job at that, just not only the genetic quality, the customer service, the follow through, all that, providing growing tips. I'm like, seeds shouldn't be cheap. A packet of seeds should probably be about $20. If, you know, if all everybody as part of the supply chain was to earn a living wage commensurate to other professions that require a similar amount of time and energy. So sometimes this idea of seed libraries or seed swaps, it's like, well, how do you ensure that people observed the necessary isolation distances? So I feel like both of those the kind of avenues should go with seed education, and mm-hmm. so and which can happen online or any or a pamphlet or whatever, so that people understand. Just because, like I mentioned, Cucurbita pipo is all the summer squash, patty pans, crooknecks, pumpkins, delicata, acorn squash, spaghetti squash, and those silly gourds. So if you're saving seed from any of those, just one in your backyard gardener, in an area where there's other backyard gardeners, you really have no way to ensure, you know, varietal purity, which is valuable because otherwise you lose the variety. And a colleague of mine, and I love him dearly, Landrace Seeds, Joseph Lofthouse out in Utah, is doing some really interesting stuff of crossing all this material to create new land races. But another mutual friend of ours, Andrew Still, who has Adaptive Seeds, which is another excellent seed company. If you're closer to the Eugene, Oregon area, I'd say check them out. Again, organic, farm-based, works with a small network of growers. He says Landrace Seeds is where heirlooms go to die. Because the only way an heirloom stays an heirloom, it's like a folk song. If you don't do the folk song with the same melody and rhythm and lyrics, it dies. You know, so some of these things, it is important to keep the purity or the story accurate. Other times, go and experiment. You know, see what happens. Last year, we grew 25 different varieties of summer squash, 10 plants each as a variety trial. And what we are doing is evaluated, how do they grow for us? We included hybrids from other companies and all our open pollinated varieties. And it wasn't just zucchini, it was everything summer squash. But we did taste tests, we had a grill set up, we invited a bunch of friends and neighbors and just got, we had little scorecards, but I let them all cross-pollinated. And now I offer that seed up, I call it compost creature mix. They'll all be good summer squash. I have no idea where they'll go, but from that, you could breed a new variety. So that's like a land race now that over time, if you save seed from the best thing, you'll get something interesting. Like you could get a green crookneck. Like that doesn't exist. I don't know why. Or a, like, I don't know, a striped patty pan or something, you know, something right. that hasn't caught on for whatever reason.
Yeah. No, it is. It's exciting. On that note, I have to say, I totally agree with you on the price of seeds. I have people who, you know, email and contact me all the time wanting to know if they can buy some of my family's strain. And I like to meet the demand, like I would have to grow so much, but unless you're doing like really large volume, I'm like the time that it takes me to plant it and to cultivate it. And I'm shelling each one out by hand. Like it's just, you know, it's just not there. Like it just doesn't make sense other than just keeping the strain for, you know, ourselves and my kids and that type of thing and our own use. So I agree with you. Like, I don't think until people have done a lot of seed saving, especially trying to keep strains pure, which I think is harder, obviously, yeah. than just, you know, just growing things out and whatnot. There is a real cost that we don't see reflected often in the actual price that's being paid. There. Yeah. So there's definitely that balance. But for those who are wanting to dive into seed saving, and we kind of actually talked about it, but just the best plants to get started with, I'm probably going to go with the lettuce, like as far as, you know, being able to see, you know, fast yield and results and not worrying about crossing, that or beans. Do you have any other favorites for people to get started with?
Yeah, I think I would say choose a self-pollinated crop and choose a cross-pollinated crop. And because you'll learn through each one, you know, so peas would be right up there, fava beans, or anything in the legume family. And then another one that you should love it too. Like I really like growing zinnias and I love all the diversity. So I'm working on like probably half a dozen different zinnia varieties. I mentioned summer squash earlier. It's not that exciting. You know, it's like, are you really going to do something better than what's already out there? Or like an onion, like, do you really think you could breed a better onion than all the varieties that are out there? And there's only so much. There's white, yellow, red, and cipollini onions or bunching onions. There's not much diversity possible there. So choose something that, for one, you plant a lot of seed of. So something like arugula or a mustard is a good one too, because you're going to be direct seeding for your salad greens. Another thing we'll do is I'll plant stripes, you know, rows of different mustards and arugula, eat it while it's there, let it bolt, it becomes beneficial insect habitat while it's flowering, let it go to seed. Even if you don't harvest the seed, you could mow that down, retill it in, and you've got a whole other bed of greens. And then all of a sudden your weeds become seeds. So I think things that you plant a lot of seed of, like a tomato, you don't need much seed of. You save seed from a bunch of tomatoes, you have lifetime supply. Something like beans or carrots or onions, something that you're direct seeding, you need a lot more seed. And that's for us. We sell the most seed of the direct seeded crops. Mm-hmm. Carrots, cilantro, beans, peas, corn, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So that's another multiple considerations. But I think first and foremost, love the plant because you'll do a better job.
I have to say my favorite is letting the dill and the carrots just go to seed. Yeah. I haven't planted or bought seed for either of those. And I don't even know how many years because they same thing. They just keep reseed. It's wonderful where I don't want them, just sit them and pull them out and then let them do their thing. So yeah. Well, thank you so much, John, for coming on. Yeah.
Thank you.
Love your guys' work. Like I said, I've been a big fan and getting seeds from you guys for a number of years now. And for those who want to dive into all the things, I'm assuming the website, siskiyouseeds.com, is the best place for people to find out more about what you're getting, looking at the seed selections and all of that. So thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that episode as much as I did. And if you are wanting to learn how to grow more of your own food, then I am doing a very special, I've never done this before, so I'm super excited and you are invited, but we are doing a virtual summit. It's going to be held this April, so you can join from anywhere. And it's the Homestead Skills Summit, Building Resilience Today. So it'll run through Monday, April 22nd through Friday, April 26th. And it is the first time that I have ever aired classes from inside the membership without having to be a member. So each day of the week, we're going to focus on a different topic. Monday is going to be our gardening day. So you're going to want to make sure that you catch that one. We are going to have a lot of videos. There's going to be some amazing giveaways, and it is something that you are not going to want to miss. However, you do have to register in order to get the links to join every day. So go to melissaknorris.com/summit, melissaknorris.com/summit, and register and snag your seat because it is going to be epic. On that note, I will be back here with you next week. Blessings and mason jars for now, my friends.